have their passports stamped. He was booked on a night flight to San Francisco with a long stopover in Mexico City. Not many people were queuing up. He probably had time to call his office and leave word for his secretary, Linda, that he would be on the flight. And perhaps he thought he should also call Malcolm. Looking around, he saw a row of phones marked ICT Telefonos International along the wall to his right, but there were only a few and all were in use. He had better use the satellite phone in his backpack, he thought, as he swung the pack off his shoulder, and perhaps it would be... He paused, frowning. He looked back at the wall. Four people were using the phones. The first was a blonde woman in shorts and a halter top, bouncing a young sunburned child in her arms as she talked. Next to her stood a bearded man in a safari jacket who glanced repeatedly at his gold Rolex watch. Then there was a gray-haired, grandmotherly woman talking in Spanish while her two full-grown sons stood by, nodding emphatically. And the last person was the helicopter pilot. He had removed his uniform jacket and was standing in short sleeves and tie. He was turned away, facing the wall, shoulders hunched. Levine moved closer and heard the pilot speaking in English. Levine set his pack down and bent over it, pretending to adjust the straps while he listened. The pilot was still turned away from him. He heard the pilot say, "No, no, Professor. It is not that way. No." Then there was a pause. "No," the pilot said. "I am telling to you, no. I am sorry, Professor Basilton, but this is not known. It is an island, but which one? We must wait again for more. No, he leaves tonight. No, I think he does not know anything. And no pictures. No. I understand. Adios." Levine ducked his head as the pilot walked briskly toward the LACSA desk at the other end of the airport. What the hell? He thought. It is an island, but which one? How did they know it was an island? Levine himself was still not sure of that. And he had been working intensively on these finds, day and night, trying to put it together. Where they had come from. Why it was happening. He walked around the corner out of sight and pulled out the little satellite phone. He dialed it quickly, calling a number in San Francisco. The call went through, rapidly clicking as it linked with the satellite. It began to ring. There was a beep. An electronic voice said, "Please enter your access code." Levine punched in a 6-digit number. There was another beep. The electronic voice said, "Leave your message." "I'm calling," Levine said, "with the results of the trip. Single specimen, not in good shape. Location BB-17 on your map. That's far south, which fits all of our hypotheses. I wasn't able to make a precise identification before they burned the specimen. But my guess is that it was an ornitholestes. As you know, this animal is not on the list. A highly significant finding." He glanced around, but no one was near him. No one was paying attention. "Furthermore, the lateral femur was cut in a deep gash. This is extremely disturbing." He hesitated, not wanting to say too much. "And I am sending back a sample that requires close examination. I also think some other people are interested. Anyway, whatever is going on down here is new, Ian. There haven't been any specimens for over a year, and now they're showing up again. Something new is happening, and we don't understand it at all." Or do we? Levine thought. He pressed the disconnect, turned the phone off, and replaced it in the outer pocket of his backpack. Maybe, he thought, we know more than we realize. He looked thoughtfully toward the departure gate. It was time to catch his flight. Palo Alto. At 2 a.m., Ed James pulled into the nearly deserted parking lot of the Marie Callender's on Carter Road. The black BMW was already there, parked near the entrance. Through the windows, he could see Dodgson sitting inside at a booth, his bland features frowning. Dodgson was never in a good mood. Right now, he was talking to the heavyset man alongside him and glancing at his watch. The heavyset man was Baselton, the professor who appeared on television. James always felt relieved whenever Baselton was there. Dodgson gave him the creeps, but it was hard to imagine Baselton involved in anything shady. James turned off the ignition and twisted the rearview mirror so he could see as he buttoned his shirt collar and pulled up his tie. He glimpsed his face in the mirror, a disheveled, tired man with a 2-day stubble of beard. What the hell, he thought. Why shouldn't he look tired? It was the middle of the fucking night. Dodgson always scheduled his meetings in the middle of the night, and always at this same damn Marie Callender restaurant. James never understood why. The coffee was awful. But then, there was a lot he didn't understand. He picked up the manila envelope and got out of the car, slamming the door. He headed for the entrance, shaking his head. Dodgson had been paying him $500 a day for weeks now to follow a bunch of scientists around. At first, James had assumed it was some sort of industrial espionage, but none of the scientists worked for industry. They held university appointments in pretty dull fields, like that paleobotanist Sadler, whose specialty was prehistoric pollen grains. James had sat through one of her lectures at Berkeley and had barely been able to stay awake. Slide after slide of little pale spheres that looked like cotton balls, while she nattered on about polysaccharide bonding angles and the Campanian-Maastrichtian boundary. Jesus, it was boring. Certainly not worth $500 a day, he thought. He went inside, blinking in the light, and walked over to the booth. He sat down, nodded to Dodgson and Baselton, and raised his hand to order coffee from the waitress. Dodgson glared at him. I haven't got all night, he said. Let's get started. Right, James said, lowering his hand. Fine, sure. He opened the envelope, began pulling out sheets and photos, handing them across the table to Dodgson as he talked. Alan Grant, paleontologist at Montana State. At the moment, he's on leave of absence and is now in Paris, lecturing on the latest dinosaur finds. Apparently he has some new ideas about tyrannosaurs being scavengers and... Never mind, Dodgson said. Go on. Ellen Sattler Ryman, James said, pushing across a photo. Botanist, used to be involved with Grant. Now married to a physicist at Berkeley and has a young son and daughter. She lectures half-time at the university. Spends the rest of her time at home because... Go on, go on. Well... Most of the rest are deceased. Donald Gennaro, lawyer, died of dysentery on a business trip. Dennis Nedry, integrated computer systems, also deceased. John Hammond, who started International Genetic Technologies, died while visiting the company's research facility in Costa Rica. Hammond had his grandchildren with him at the time. The kids live with their mother back east, and... Anybody contact them? Anybody from InGen? No. No contact. The boys started college and the girls in prep school. And InGen filed for Chapter 11 protection after Hammond died. It's been in the courts ever since. The hard assets are finally being sold off. During the last 2 weeks, as a matter of fact. Baselton spoke for the first time. Is Site B involved in that sale? James looked blank. Site B? Yes. Has anybody talked to you about Site B? No, I've never heard of it before. What is it? If you hear anything about Site B, Baselton said, we want to know. Sitting beside Bazelton in the booth, Dodgson thumbed through the pictures and data sheets, then tossed them aside impatiently. He looked up at James. "What else have you got?" "That's all, Dr. Dodgson." "That's all?" Dodgson said. "What about Malcolm? And what about Levine? Are they still friends?" James consulted his notes. "I'm not sure." Bazelton frowned. "Not sure?" he said. "What do you mean, you're not sure?" "Malcolm met Levine at the Santa Fe Institute," James said. "They spent time together there a couple of years ago. But Malcolm hasn't gone back to Santa Fe recently. He's taken a visiting lectureship at Berkeley in the biology department. He teaches mathematical models of evolution. And he seems to have lost contact with Levine."
"They have a falling out?"
"Maybe. I was told they argued about Levine's expedition."
"What expedition?" Dodgson said, leaning forward.
"Levine's been planning some kind of expedition for a year or so. He's ordered special vehicles from a company called Mobile Field Systems. It's a small operation in Woodside, run by a guy named Jack Thorne. Thorne outfits jeeps and trucks for scientists doing field research. Scientists in Africa and Sichuan and Chile all swear by them."
"Malcolm knows about this expedition?"
"He must. He's gone to Thorne's place occasionally. Every month or so. And of course, Levine's been going there almost every day. That's how he got thrown in jail."
"Thrown in jail?" Bazelton said.
"Yeah," James said, glancing at his notes. "Let's see. February 10th, Levine was arrested for driving 120 in a 15 zone. Right in front of Woodside Junior High. The judge impounded his Ferrari, yanked his license, and gave him community service. Basically ordered him to teach a class at the school."
Bazelton smiled. "Richard Levine, teaching junior high. I'd love to see that."
"He's been pretty conscientious. Of course, he's spending time in Woodside anyway, with Thorne. That is, until he left the country."
"When did he leave the country?" Dodgson said.
2 days ago. He went to Costa Rica. Short trip. He was due back early this morning."
"And where is he now?"
"I don't know. And I'm afraid, it's going to be hard to find out."
"Why is that?"
James hesitated, coughed.
"Because he was on the passenger manifest of the flight from Costa Rica, but he wasn't on the plane when it landed. My contact in Costa Rica says he checked out of his hotel in San Jose before the flight and never went back. Didn't take any other flight out of the city. So, for the moment, I'm afraid that Richard Levine has disappeared."
There was a long silence. Dodgson sat back in the booth, hissing between his teeth. He looked at Bazelton, who shook his head. Dodgson very carefully picked up all the sheets of paper, tapped them on the table, making a neat stack. He slipped them back into the manila envelope and handed the envelope to James.
"Now listen, you stupid son of a bitch," Dodgson said. "There's only one thing I want from you now. It's very simple. Are you listening?"
James swallowed.
"I'm listening."
Dodgson leaned across the table.
"Find him," he said.
Berkeley. In his cluttered office, Malcolm looked up from his desk as his assistant, Beverly, came into the room. She was followed by a man from DHL carrying a small box.
"I'm sorry to disturb you, Dr. Malcolm, but you have to sign these forms. It's that sample from Costa Rica."
Malcolm stood and walked around the desk. He didn't use his cane.
In recent weeks, he had been working steadily to walk without the cane. He still had occasional pain in his leg, but he was determined to make progress. Even his physical therapist, a perpetually cheery woman named Cindy, had commented on it.
"Gee, after all these years, suddenly you're motivated, Dr. Malcolm," she had said. "What's going on?"
"Oh, you know," Malcolm had said to her, "can't rely on a cane forever." The truth was rather different. Confronted by Levine's relentless enthusiasm for the Lost World hypothesis, his excited telephone calls at all hours of the day and night, Malcolm had begun to reconsider his own views. And he had come to believe that it was quite possible, even probable, that extinct animals existed in a remote, previously unsuspected location. Malcolm had his own reasons for thinking so, which he had only hinted at to Levine. But the possibility of another island location was what led him to walk unaided. He wanted to prepare for a future visit to this island, and so he had begun to make the effort day after day. He and Levine had narrowed their search down to a string of islands along the Costa Rican coast, and Levine was, as always, very intense in his excitement. But to Malcolm, it remained hypothetical. He refused to get excited until there was hard evidence, photographs or actual tissue samples, to demonstrate the existence of new animals. And so far, Malcolm had seen nothing at all. He was not sure whether he was disappointed or relieved. But in any case, Levine's sample had arrived. Malcolm took the clipboard from the delivery man and quickly signed the top form. Delivery of excluded materials, samples, biological research. The delivery man said, "You have to check the boxes, sir." Malcolm looked at the list of questions running down the page, with a checkbox beside each. Was the specimen alive? Was the specimen cultures of bacteria, fungi, viruses, or protozoa? Was the specimen registered under an established research protocol? Was the specimen contagious? Was the specimen taken from a farm or animal husbandry site? Was the specimen plant matter, propagative seeds, or bulbs? Was the specimen insect or insect-related? He checked off no to everything.
"And the next page, too, sir," the delivery man said.
He was looking around the office, at the stacks of papers heaped untidily about, the maps on the walls with the colored pins stuck in them.
"You do medical research here?"
Malcolm flipped the page, scrawled his signature on the next form. "No."
"And one more, sir?"
The third form was a release of liability to the carrier. Malcolm signed it as well. The delivery man said, "Have a good day," and left. Immediately, Malcolm sagged, resting his weight on the edge of the desk. He winced.
"Still hurt?" Beverly said.
She took the specimen to the side table, pushed some papers away, and began to unwrap it.
"I'm okay."
He looked over at the cane, resting beside his chair behind the desk. Then he took a breath and crossed the room slowly. Beverly had the wrapping off the package, revealing a small stainless steel cylinder the size of his fist. A triple-bladed biohazard sign was taped across the screw-top lid. Attached to the cylinder was a second small canister with a metal valve. It contained the refrigerant gas. Malcolm swung the light over the cylinder and said,
"Let's see what he was so excited about."
He broke the taped seal and unscrewed the lid. There was a hiss of gas and a faint white puff of condensation. The exterior of the cylinder frosted over. Peering in, he saw a plastic baggie and a sheet of paper. He upended the cylinder, dumping the contents onto the table. The baggie contained a ragged piece of greenish flesh about 2 inches square, with a small green plastic tag attached to it. He held it up to the light, examined it with a magnifying glass, then set it down again. He looked at the green skin, the pebbled texture.
"Maybe," he thought. "Maybe." Beverly, he said, call Elizabeth Gelman over at the zoo. Tell her I have something I want her to look at. And tell her it's confidential.
Beverly nodded and went out of the room to phone. Alone, Malcolm unrolled the strip of paper that had come with the sample. It was a piece of paper torn from a yellow legal pad. In block printing, it said, I was right and you were wrong. Malcolm frowned.
That son of a bitch, he thought.
Beverly, after you call Elizabeth, get Richard Levine at his office. I need to talk to him right away.
The Lost World. Richard Levine pressed his face to the warm rock cliff and paused to catch his breath. 500 feet below, the ocean surged, waves thundering brilliant white against the black rocks. The boat that had brought him was already heading east again, a small white speck on the horizon. It had to return, for there was no safe harbor anywhere on this desolate, inhospitable island. For now, they were on their own. Levine took a deep breath and looked down at Diego, 20 feet below him on the cliff face. Diego was burdened with the backpack that contained all their equipment, but he was young and strong. He smiled cheerfully and nodded his head upward.
Have courage. It is not far now, senor.
I hope so, Levine said. When he had examined the cliff through binoculars from the boat, this had seemed like a good place to make the ascent. But in fact, the cliff face was nearly vertical and incredibly dangerous because the volcanic rock was crumbling and friable. Levine raised his arms, fingers extending upward, reaching for the next handhold. He clung to the rock. Small pebbles broke free and his hand slipped down. He gripped again, then pulled himself upward. He was breathing hard, from exertion and fear.
Just 20 meters more, senor, Diego said encouragingly. You can do it.
I'm sure I can, Levine muttered, considering the alternative.
As he neared the top of the cliff, the wind blew harder, whistling in his ears, tugging at his clothes. It felt as if it was trying to suck him away from the rock. Looking up, he saw the dense foliage that grew right to the edge of the cliff face. Almost there, he thought. Almost. And then, with a final heave, he pushed himself over the top and collapsed, rolling in soft, wet ferns. Still gasping, he looked back and saw Diego come over lightly, easily. He squatted on the mossy grass and smiled. Levine turned away, staring at the huge ferns overhead, releasing the accumulated tension of the climb in long, shuddering breaths. His legs burned fiercely. But no matter. He was here. Finally. He looked at the jungle around him. It was primary forest, undisturbed by the hand of man. Exactly as the satellite images had shown. Levine had been forced to rely on satellite photographs because there were no maps available of private islands such as this one. This island existed as a kind of lost world, isolated in the midst of the Pacific Ocean. Levine listened to the sound of the wind, the rustle of the palm fronds that dripped water onto his face. And then he heard another sound, distant, like the cry of a bird, but deeper, more resonant. As he listened, he heard it again. A sharp sizzle nearby made him look over. Diego had struck a match, was raising it to light a cigarette. Quickly, Levine sat up, pushed the younger man's hand away and shook his head, no. Diego frowned, puzzled. Levine put his finger to his lips. He pointed in the direction of the bird sound. Diego shrugged, his expression indifferent. He was unimpressed. He saw no reason for concern. That was because he didn't understand what they were up against, Levine thought, as he unzipped the dark green backpack and began to assemble the big Lindstrat rifle. The rifle had been specially manufactured for him in Sweden and represented the latest in animal control technology. He screwed the barrel into the stock,
locked in the Fluger clip, checked the gas charge, and handed the rifle to Diego. Diego took it with another shrug. Meanwhile, Levine removed the black anodized Lindstrock pistol in its holster and buckled it around his waist. He removed the pistol, checked the safety twice, and put the pistol back in the holster. Levine got to his feet, gestured for Diego to follow him. Diego zipped up the backpack and shouldered it again. The two men started down the sloping hillside away from the cliff. Almost immediately, their clothes were soaked from the wet foliage. They had no views. They were surrounded on all sides by dense jungle and could see only a few yards ahead. The fronds of the ferns were enormous, as long and broad as a man's body, the plants 20 feet tall with rough, spiky stalks. And high above the ferns, a great canopy of trees blocked most of the sunlight. They moved in darkness, silently, on damp, spongy earth. Levine paused often to consult his wrist compass. They were heading west, down a steep slope toward the interior of the island. He knew that the island was the remains of an ancient volcanic crater, eroded and decomposed by centuries of weathering. The interior terrain consisted of a series of ridges that led down to the floor of the crater. But particularly here on the eastern side, the landscape was steep, rugged, and treacherous. The sense of isolation, of having returned to a primordial world, was palpable. Levine's heart pounded as he continued down the slope, across a marshy stream, and then up again. At the top of the next ridge, there was a break in the foliage, and he felt a welcome breeze. From his vantage point, he was able to see to the far side of the island, a rim of hard, black cliff miles away. Between here and the cliffs, they saw nothing but gently undulating jungle. Standing beside him, Diego said, "Fantástico." Levine quickly shushed him. "But, senor," he protested, pointing to the view. "We are alone here." Levine shook his head, annoyed. He had gone over all this with Diego during the boat ride over. Once on the island, no speaking. No hair pomade, no cologne, no cigarettes. All food sealed tightly in plastic bags. Everything packed with great care. Nothing to produce a smell or make a sound. He had warned Diego again and again of the importance of all these precautions. But now it was obvious that Diego had paid no attention. He didn't understand. Levine poked Diego angrily and shook his head again. Diego smiled. "Señor, please. There are only birds here." At that moment, they heard a deep, rumbling sound, an unearthly cry that arose from somewhere in the forest below them. After a moment, the cry was answered from another part of the forest. Diego's eyes widened. Levine mouthed, "Birds?" Diego was silent. He bit his lip and stared out at the forest. To the south, they saw a place where the tops of the trees began to move, a whole section of forest that suddenly seemed to come alive, as if brushed by wind. But the rest of the forest was not moving. It was not the wind. Diego crossed himself quickly. They heard more cries, lasting nearly a minute, and then silence descended again. Levine moved off the ridge and headed down the jungle slope, going deeper into the interior. He was moving forward quickly, looking at the ground, watching for snakes, when he heard a low whistle behind him. He turned and saw Diego pointing to the left. Levine doubled back, pushed through the fronds, and followed Diego as he moved south. In a few moments, they came upon two parallel tracks in the dirt, long since overgrown with grass and ferns, but clearly recognizable as an old jeep trail, leading off into the jungle. Of course, they would follow it. He knew their progress would be much faster on a road. Levine gestured, and Diego took off the backpack. It was Levine's turn. He shouldered the weight, adjusted the straps.
In silence, they started down the road. In places, the jeep track was hardly recognizable, so thickly had the jungle grown back. Clearly, no one had used this road for many years, and the jungle was always ready to return. Behind him, Diego grunted, swore softly. Levine turned and saw Diego lifting his foot gingerly. He had stepped to mid-ankle in a pile of green animal droppings. Levine went back. Diego scraped his boot clean on the stem of a fern. The droppings appeared to be composed of pale flecks of hay mixed with green. The material was light and crumbly, dried, old. There was no smell. Levine searched the ground carefully until he found the remainder of the original spore. The droppings were well formed, 12 centimeters in diameter, definitely left behind by some large herbivore. Diego was silent, but his eyes were wide. Levine shook his head, continued on. As long as they saw signs of herbivora, he wasn't going to worry. At least, not too much. Even so, his fingers touched the butt of his pistol, as if for reassurance. They came to a stream, muddy banks on both sides. Here, Levine paused. He saw clear 3-toed footprints in the mud, some of them quite large. The palm of his own hand, fingers spread wide, fitted easily inside one of the prints, with room to spare. When he looked up, Diego was crossing himself again. He held the rifle in his other hand. They waded at the stream, listening to the gentle gurgle of the water. Something shiny glinted in the stream, catching his eye. He bent over and plucked it out. It was a piece of glass tubing, roughly the size of a pencil. One end was broken off. There were graduated markings along the side. He realized it was a pipette, of the kind used in laboratories everywhere in the world. Levine held it up to the light, turning it in his fingers. It was odd, he thought. A pipette like this implied... Levine turned and caught a glimpse of movement out of the corner of his eye. Something small and brown, scurrying across the mud of the riverbank. Something about the size of a rat. Diego grunted in surprise. Then it was gone, disappearing in foliage. Levine moved forward and crouched in the mud by the stream. He peered at the footprints left by the tiny animal. The footprints were 3-toed, like the tracks of a bird. He saw more 3-toed tracks, including some bigger ones, which were several inches across. Levine had seen such prints before, in trackways such as the Purgatoire River in Colorado, where the ancient shoreline was now fossilized, the dinosaur tracks frozen in stone. But these prints were in fresh mud. And they had been made by living animals. Sitting on his haunches, Levine heard a soft squeak coming from somewhere to his right. Looking over, he saw the ferns moving slightly. He stayed very still, waiting. After a moment, a small animal peeked out from among the fronds. It appeared to be the size of a mouse. It had smooth, hairless skin and large eyes mounted high on its tiny head. It was greenish-brown in color, and it made a continuous, irritable squeaking sound at Levine as if to drive him away. Levine stayed motionless, hardly daring to breathe. He recognized this creature, of course. It was a Musaurus, a tiny prosauropod from the late Triassic. Skeletal remains were found only in South America. It was one of the smallest dinosaurs known. A dinosaur, he thought. Even though he had expected to see them on this island, it was still startling to be confronted by a living, breathing member of the Dinosauria, especially one so small. He could not take his eyes off it. He was entranced. After all these years, after all the dusty skeletons, an actual living dinosaur.
The little Musar ventured farther out from the protection of the fronds. Now Levine could see that it was longer than he had thought at first. It was actually about 10 centimeters long, with a surprisingly thick tail. All told, it looked very much like a lizard. It sat upright, squatting on its hind legs on the frond. He saw the rib cage moving as the animal breathed. It waved its tiny forearms in the air at Levine and squeaked repeatedly. Slowly, very slowly, Levine extended his hand. The creature squeaked again, but did not run. If anything, it seemed curious, cocking its head the way very small animals do as Levine's hand came closer. Finally, Levine's fingers touched the tip of the frond. The Musar stood on its hind legs, balancing with its outstretched tail. Showing no sign of fear, it stepped lightly onto Levine's hand and stood in the creases of his palm. He hardly felt the weight, it was so light. The Musar walked around, sniffed Levine's fingers. Levine smiled, charmed. Then suddenly, the little creature hissed in annoyance and jumped off his hand, disappearing into the palms. Levine blinked, unable to understand why. Then he smelled a foul odor and heard a heavy rustling in the bushes on the other side. There was a soft grunting sound. More rustling. For a brief moment, Levine remembered that carnivores in the wild hunted near stream beds, attacking animals when they were vulnerable, bending over to drink. But the recognition came too late. He heard a terrifying, high-pitched cry, and when he turned, he saw that Diego was screaming as his body was hauled away into the bushes. Diego struggled. The bushes shook fiercely. Levine caught a glimpse of a single large foot, its middle toe bearing a short, curving claw. Then the foot pulled back. The bushes continued to shake. Suddenly, the forest erupted in frightening animal roars all around him. He glimpsed a large animal charging him. Richard Levine turned and fled, feeling the adrenaline surge of pure panic, not knowing where to go, knowing only that it was hopeless. He felt a heavy weight suddenly tear at his backpack, forcing him to his knees in the mud, and he realized in that moment that despite all his planning, despite all his clever deductions, things had gone terribly wrong, and he was about to die. School. When we consider mass extinction from a meteor impact, Richard Levine said, we must ask several questions. First, are there any impact craters on our planet larger than 19 miles in diameter, which is the smallest size necessary to cause a worldwide extinction event? And second, do any craters match in time a known extinction? It turns out there are a dozen craters this large around the world, of which 5 coincide with known extinctions. Kelly Curtis yawned in the darkness of her 7th grade classroom. Sitting at her desk, she propped her chin on her elbows and tried to stay awake. She already knew this stuff. The TV set in front of the class showed a vast cornfield, seen in an aerial view, the curving outlines faintly visible. She recognized it as the crater in Manson. In the darkness, Dr. Levine's recorded voice said, "This is the crater in Manson, Iowa, dating from 65 million years ago, just when dinosaurs became extinct." But was this the meteor that killed the dinosaurs? No, Kelly thought, yawning. Probably the Yucatan Peninsula. Manson was too small. "We now think this crater is too small," Dr. Levine said aloud. "We believe it was too small by an order of magnitude, and the current candidate is the crater near Mérida, in the Yucatan. It seems difficult to imagine, but the impact emptied the entire Gulf of Mexico, causing 2,000-foot-high tidal waves to wash over the land. It must have been incredible."
But there are disputes about this crater, too, particularly concerning the meaning of the cenote ring structure and the differential death rates of phytoplankton in ocean deposits. That may sound complicated, but don't worry about it for now. We'll go into it in more detail next time. So, that's it for today. The lights came up. Their teacher, Mrs. Menzies, stepped to the front of the class and turned off the computer, which had been running the display and the lecture. "Well," she said, "I'm glad Dr. Levine gave us this recording. He told me he might not be back in time for today's lecture, but he'll be with us again for sure when we return from spring break next week. Kelly, you and Arby are working for Dr. Levine. Is that what he told you?" Kelly glanced over at Arby, who was slouched low in his seat, frowning. "Yes, Mrs. Menzies," Kelly said. "Good. All right, everyone, the assignment for the holidays is all of Chapter 7. There were groans from the class. "Including all of the exercises at the end of Part 1 as well as Part 2. Be sure to bring that with you, completed when we return. Have a good spring break. We'll see you back here in a week." The bell rang. The class got up, chairs scraping, the room suddenly noisy. Arby drifted over to Kelly. He looked up at her mournfully. Arby was a head shorter than Kelly. He was the shortest person in the class. He was also the youngest. Kelly was 13, like the other seventh graders, but Arby was only 11. He had already been skipped 2 grades because he was so smart, and there were rumors he would be skipped again. Arby was a genius, particularly with computers. Arby put his pen in the pocket of his white button-down shirt and pushed his horn-rimmed glasses up on his nose. R.B. Benton was black. Both his parents were doctors in San Jose, and they always made sure he was dressed very neatly, like a college kid or something. Which, Kelly reflected, he would probably be in a couple of years, the way he was going. Standing next to Arby, Kelly always felt awkward and gawky. Kelly had to wear her sister's old clothes, which her mother had bought from Kmart about 1 million years ago. She even had to wear Emily's old Reeboks, which were so scuffed and dirty that they never came clean, even after Kelly ran them through the washing machine. Kelly washed and ironed all her own clothes. Her mother never had time. Her mother was never even home most of the time. Kelly looked enviously at Arby's neatly pressed khakis, his polished penny loafers, and sighed. Still, even though she was jealous, Arby was her only real friend. The only person who thought it was okay that she was smart. Kelly worried that he'd be skipped to 9th grade and she wouldn't see him anymore. Beside her, Arby still frowned. He looked up at her and said, "Why isn't Dr. Levine here?" "I don't know," she said. "Maybe something happened."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Something."
"But he promised he would be here," Arby said, "to take us on the field trip. It was all arranged. We got permission and everything."
"So? We can still go."
"But he should be here," Arby insisted stubbornly.
Kelly had seen this behavior before. Arby was accustomed to adults being reliable. His parents were both very reliable. Kelly wasn't troubled by such ideas.
"Never mind, Arb," she said. "Let's just go see Dr. Thorne ourselves."
"You think so?"
"Sure, why not?"
Arby hesitated.
"Maybe I should call my mom first."
"Why?" Kelly said. "You know she'll tell you that you have to go home."
"Come on, Arb. Let's just go."
He hesitated, still troubled. Arby might be smart, but any change in plan always bothered him. Kelly knew from experience he would grumble and argue if she pushed for them to go alone. She had to wait while he made up his own mind.
"Okay," he said finally. "Let's go see Thorne."
Kelly grinned. "Meet you in front," she said. "In 5 minutes." As she went down the stairs from the second floor, the sing-song chant began again. "Kelly is a brainer, Kelly is a brainer." She held her head high. It was that stupid Allison Stone and her stupid friends, standing at the bottom of the stairs, taunting her. Kelly is a brainer. She swept past the girls, ignoring them. Nearby, she saw Miss Enders, the hall monitor, paying no attention as usual, even though Mr. Canosa, the assistant principal, had recently made a special homeroom announcement about teasing kids. Behind her, the girls called, Kelly is a brainer. She's the queen of the screen, and it's gonna turn her green. They collapsed in laughter. Up ahead, she saw Arby waiting by the door, a bundle of gray cables in his hand. She hurried forward. When she got to him, he said, Forget it. They're stupid jerk-offs.
Right.
I don't care anyway.
I know. Just forget it.
Behind them, the girls were giggling. Kelly and Arby going to a party. Take a bath in their math. They went outside into the sunlight, the sounds of the girls thankfully drowned in the noise of everyone going home. Yellow school buses were in the parking lot. Kids were streaming down the steps to their parents' cars, which were lined up all around the block. There was a lot of activity. Arby ducked a frisbee that whooshed over his head and glanced toward the street. There he is again.
Well, don't look at him, Kelly said.
I'm not.
Remember what Dr. Levine said.
Geez, Kel, I remember, okay? Across the street was parked the plain gray Taurus sedan that they had seen, off and on, for the past 2 months. Behind the wheel, pretending to read a newspaper, was that same man with the scraggly growth of beard. This bearded man had been following Dr. Levine ever since he started to teach the class at Woodside. Kelly believed that man was the reason why Dr. Levine asked her and Arby to be his assistants in the first place. Levine had told them their job would be to help him by carrying equipment, Xeroxing class assignments, collecting homework, and routine things like that. They thought it would be a big honor to work for Dr. Levine, or anyway, interesting to work for an actual professional scientist, so they had agreed to do it. But it turned out there never was anything to be done for the class. Dr. Levine did all that himself. Instead, he sent them on lots of little errands. And he had told them to be careful to avoid this bearded man in the car. That wasn't hard. The man never paid any attention to them, because they were kids. Dr. Levine had explained the bearded man was following him because of something to do with his arrest, but Kelly didn't believe that. Her own mother had been arrested twice for drunk driving, and there was never anybody following her. So Kelly didn't know why this man was following Levine, but clearly Levine was doing some secret research and he didn't want anybody to find out about it. She knew one thing. Dr. Levine didn't care much about this class he was teaching. He usually gave the lecture off the top of his head. Other times he would walk in the front door of the school, hand them a taped lecture, and walk out the back. They never knew where he went on those days. The errands he sent them on were mysterious, too. Once they went to Stanford and picked up 5 small squares of plastic from a professor there. The plastic was light and sort of foamy. Another time they went downtown to an electronics store and picked up a triangular device that the man behind the counter gave them very nervously, as if it might be illegal or something. Another time they picked up a metal tube that looked like it contained cigars. They couldn't help opening it, but they were uneasy to find 4 sealed plastic ampoules of straw-colored liquid. The ampoules were marked Extreme Danger, Lethal Toxicity, and had the 3-bladed international symbol for biohazard. But mostly their assignments were mundane. He often sent them to libraries at Stanford to Xerox papers on all sorts of subjects, Japanese sword-making, X-ray crystallography, Mexican vampire bats, Central American volcanoes, oceanic currents of El Nino, the mating behavior of mountain sheep, sea cucumber toxicity, flying buttresses of Gothic cathedrals. Dr. Levine never explained why he was interested in these subjects. Often he would send them back day after day to search for more material. And then, suddenly, he would drop the subject and never refer to it again. And they would be on to something else. Of course, they could figure some of it out. A lot of the questions had to do with the vehicles that Dr. Thorne was building for Dr. Levine's expedition. But most of the time, the subjects were completely mysterious. Occasionally, Kelly wondered what the bearded man would make of all this. She wondered whether he knew something they did not. But actually, the bearded man seemed kind of lazy. He never seemed to figure out that Kelly and Arby were doing errands for Dr. Levine. Right now, the bearded man glanced over at the entrance to the school, ignoring them. They walked to the end of the street and sat on the bench to wait for the bus. Tag. The baby snow leopard spit the bottle out and rolled over onto its back, paws in the air. It made a soft, mewing sound.
She wants to be petted, Elizabeth Gilman said.
Malcolm reached out his hand to stroke the belly. The cub spun around and sunk its tiny teeth into his fingers. Malcolm yelled.
She does that sometimes, Gelman said. Dorja, bad girl. Is that any way to treat our distinguished visitor?
She reached out, took Malcolm's hand.
It didn't break the skin, but we should clean it anyway.
They were in the White Research Laboratory of the San Francisco Zoo at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Elizabeth Gelman, the youthful head of research, was supposed to report on her findings, but they had to delay for the afternoon feeding in the nursery. Malcolm had watched them feed a baby gorilla, which spit up like a human baby, and a koala, and then the very cute snow leopard cub.
Sorry about that, Gelman said.
She took him to a side basin and soaped his hand.
But I thought it was better that you come here now when the regular staff is all at the weekly conference.
Why is that?
Because there's a lot of interest in the material you gave us, Ian.
A lot. She dried his hand with a towel, inspected it again.
I think you'll survive.
What have you found? Malcolm said to her.
You have to admit, it is very provocative.
By the way, is it from Costa Rica? Keeping his voice neutral, Malcolm said,
Why do you say that?
Because there are all these rumors about unknown animals showing up in Costa Rica.
And this is definitely an unknown animal, Ian.
She led him out of the nursery and into a small conference room. He dropped into a chair, resting his cane on the table. She lowered the lights and clicked on a slide projector.
Okay.
Here's a close-up of your original material before we began our examination. As you see, it consists of a fragment of animal tissue in a state of very advanced necrosis. The tissue measures 4 centimeters by 6 centimeters. Attached to it is a green plastic tag measuring 2 centimeters square. Tissue cut by a knife, but not a very sharp one. Malcolm nodded.
What did you use, Ian? Your pocket knife?
Something like that.
All right. Let's deal with the tissue sample first.
The slide changed. Malcolm saw a microscopic view.
This is a gross histologic section through the superficial epidermis. Those patchy, ragged gaps are where the post-mortem necrotic change has eroded the skin surface. But what is interesting is the arrangement of epidermal cells. You'll notice the density of chromatophores, or pigment-bearing cells. In the cut section, you see the difference between melanophores here and allophores here. The overall pattern is suggestive of a Lacerta or Amblyrhynchus.
You mean a lizard? Malcolm said.
Yes, she said. It looks like a lizard, though the picture is not entirely consistent.
She tapped the left side of the screen. You see this one cell here, which has this slight rim in section? We believe that's muscle. The chromatophore could open and close, meaning that this animal could change color like a chameleon. And over here, you see this large oval shape with a pale center? That's the pore of a femoral scent gland. There is a waxy substance in the center, which we are still analyzing. But our presumption is that this animal was male, since only male lizards have femoral glands.
I see, Malcolm said.
She changed the slide. Malcolm saw what looked like a close-up of a sponge.
Going deeper.
Here we see the structure of the subcutaneous layers, highly distorted because of gas bubbles from the Clostridia infection that bloated the animal. But you can get a sense of the vessels. See, one here and another here, which are surrounded by smooth muscle fibers. This is not characteristic of lizards. In fact, the whole appearance of this slide is wrong for lizards, or reptiles of any sort.
You mean it looks warm-blooded?
Right, Gelman said. Not really mammalian, but perhaps avian.
This could be, oh, I don't know, a dead pelican, something like that.
Uh-huh. Except no pelican has a skin like that.
I see, Malcolm said.
And there's no feathers.
Uh-huh.
Now, Gelman said, we were able to extract a minute quantity of blood from the intra-arterial spaces. Not much, but enough to conduct a microscopic examination. Here it is. The slide changed again. He saw a jumble of cells, mostly red cells, and an occasional misshapen white cell. It was confusing to look at.
This isn't my area, Elizabeth, he said.
Well, I'll just give you the highlights, she said. First of all, nucleated red cells. That's characteristic of birds, not mammals. Second, rather atypical hemoglobin, differing in several base pairs from other lizards. Third, aberrant white cell structure. We don't have enough material to make a determination, but we suspect this animal has a highly unusual immune system.
Whatever that means, Malcolm said with a shrug.
We don't know, and the sample doesn't give us enough to find out. By the way, can you get more?
I might be able to, he said.
Where? From Site B?
Malcolm looked puzzled.
Site B? Well, that's what's embossed on the tag.
She changed the slide.
I must say, Ian, this tag is very interesting.
Here at the zoo, we tag animals all the time, and we're familiar with all the ordinary commercial brands sold around the world. Nobody's seen this tag before.
Here it is, magnified 10 times. The actual object is roughly the size of your thumbnail. Uniform plastic outer surface attaches to the animal by a Teflon-coated stainless steel clip on the other side. It's a rather small clip of the kind used to tag infants. The animal you saw was adult?
Presumably.
So the tag was probably in place for a while, ever since the animal was young, Gelman said. Which makes sense, considering the degree of weathering. You'll notice the pitting on the surface? That's very unusual. This plastic is Duralon, the stuff they use to make football helmets. It's extremely tough, and this pitting can't have occurred through simple wear.
Then what?
It's almost certainly a chemical reaction, such as exposure to acid, perhaps in aerosol form.
Like volcanic fumes, Malcolm said.
That could do it, particularly in view of what else we've learned. You'll notice that the tag is rather thick. Actually, it's 9 millimeters across. And it's hollow.
Hollow, Malcolm said, frowning.
Yes. It contains an inner cavity. We didn't want to open it, so we x-rayed it. Here. The slide changed. Malcolm saw a jumble of white lines and boxes inside the tag.
There appears to be substantial corrosion, again perhaps from acid fumes, but there's no question what this once was.
It's a radio tag, Ian. Which means that this unusual animal, this warm-blooded lizard or whatever it was tagged and raised by somebody from birth. And that's the part that's got people around here upset. Somebody's raising these things. Do you know how that happened?
I haven't the faintest idea, Malcolm said.
Elizabeth Gelman sighed.
You're a lying son of a bitch.
He held out his hand. May I have my sample back? She said,
Ian, after all I've done for you.
The sample?
I think you owe me an explanation.
And I promise you'll have one. In about 2 weeks. I'll buy dinner. She tossed a silver foil package on the table. He picked it up and slipped it in his pocket.
Thanks, Liz.
He got up to go.
I hate to run, but I've got to make a call right away.
He started for the door, and she said, By the way, how did it die, Ian? This animal. He paused.
Why do you ask?
Because when we teased up the skin cells, we found a few foreign cells under the outer epidermal layer. Cells belonging to another animal.
Meaning what?
Well, it's the typical picture you see when two lizards fight. They rub against each other. Cells get pushed under the superficial layer.
Yes, he said. There were signs of a fight on a carcass. The animal had been wounded.
And you should also know there were signs of chronic vasoconstriction in the arterial vessels. This animal was under stress, Ian. And not just from the fight that wounded it. That would have disappeared in early postmortem changes. I'm talking about chronic, continuous stress. Wherever this creature lived, its environment was extremely stressful and dangerous.
I see.
So, how come a tagged animal has such a stressful life?
At the entrance to the zoo, he looked around to see if he was being followed, then stopped at a payphone and dialed Levine. The machine picked up. Levine wasn't there.
Typical, Malcolm thought.
Whenever you needed him, he wasn't there. Probably off trying to get his Ferrari out of impound again. Malcolm hung up and headed toward his car.
Thorn Mobile Field Systems was stenciled in black lettering on a large rolling metal garage door at the far end of the industrial park. There was a regular door to the left. Arby pushed the buzzer on a small box with a grill. A gruff voice said, Go away.
It's us, Dr. Thorn. Arby and Kelly.
Oh. Okay. There was a click as the door unlocked and they walked inside. They found themselves in a large open shed. Workmen were making modifications on several vehicles. The air smelled of acetylene, engine oil, and fresh paint. Directly ahead, Kelly saw a dark green Ford Explorer with its roof cut open. Two assistants stood on ladders, fitting a large flat panel of black solar cells over the top of the car. The hood of the Explorer was up and the V6 engine had been pulled out. Workmen were now lowering a small new engine in its place. It looked like a rounded shoebox with the dull shine of aluminum alloy. Others were bringing the wide, flat rectangle of the Hughes converter that would be mounted on top of the motor. Over to the right, she saw the two RV trailers that Thorne's team had been working on for the last few weeks. They weren't the usual trailers you saw people driving for the weekends. One was enormous and sleek, almost as big as a bus, and outfitted with living and sleeping quarters for four people, as well as all sorts of special scientific equipment.
It was called Challenger, and it had an unusual feature. Once you parked it, the walls could slide outward, expanding the inside dimensions. The Challenger trailer was made to connect up through a special accordion passageway to the second trailer, which was somewhat smaller and was pulled by the first. This second RV contained laboratory equipment and some very high-tech refinements, though Kelly wasn't sure exactly what. Right now, the second trailer was nearly hidden by the huge stream of sparks that spit out from a welder on the roof. Despite all the activity, the trailer looked mostly finished. Although she could see people working inside, and all the upholstery, the chairs and seats were lying around on the ground outside. Thorn himself was standing in the middle of the room, shouting at the welder on the roof of the camper. "Come on, come on, we've got to be finished today! Eddie, let's go!" He turned, shouted again. "No, no, no! Look at the plans! Henry, you can't place that strut laterally! It has to be crosswise for strength! Look at the plans!" Doc Thorne was a gray-haired, barrel-chested man of 55. Except for his wire-frame glasses, he looked as if he might be a retired prizefighter. It was hard for Kelly to imagine Thorne as a university professor. He was immensely strong and in continuous movement. "Damn it, Henry! Henry! Henry, are you listening to me?" Thorne swore again and shook his fist in the air. He turned to the kids. "These guys," he said, "they're supposed to be helping me." From the Explorer, there was a white-hot crack like lightning. The two men leaning into the hood jumped away as a cloud of acrid smoke rose above the car. "What did I tell you?" Thorne shouted. "Ground it! Ground it before you do anything! We've got serious voltages here, guys! You're gonna get fried if you're not careful!" He looked back at the kids and shook his head. "They just don't get it," he said. "That IUD is serious defense."
"IUD?"
"Internal Ursine Deterrent. That's what Levine calls it." "It's his idea of a joke," Thorne said. "Actually, I developed this system a few years back for park rangers in Yellowstone, where bears break into trailers. Flip a switch, and you run 10,000 volts across the outer skin of the trailer. Whammo! Takes the fight out of the biggest bear. But that kind of voltage will blow these guys right off the trailer. And then what? I get a workman's compensation suit. For their stupidity." He shook his head. "So, where's Levine?"
"We don't know," Arby said.
"What do you mean? Didn't he teach your class today?"
"No, he didn't come."
Thorne swore again. "Well, I need him today to go over the final revisions before we do our field testing. He was supposed to be back today."
"Back from where?" Kelly said.
"Oh, he went on one of his field trips," Thorne said. "Very excited about it before he went. I outfitted him myself. Loaned him my latest field pack. Everything he could ever want in just 47 pounds. He liked it. Left last Monday, 4 days ago."
"For where?"
"How should I know?" Thorne said. "He wouldn't tell me. And I gave up asking. You know they're all the same now. Every scientist I deal with is secretive. But you can't blame them. They're all afraid of being ripped off or sued. The modern world. Last year I built equipment for an expedition to the Amazon. We waterproofed it, which you'd want in the Amazon rainforest. Soaking wet electronics just don't work. And the principal scientist was charged with misappropriating funds. For waterproofing. Some university bureaucrat said it was an unnecessary expense. I'm telling you, it's insane. Just insane. Henry, did you hear anything I said to you? Put it crosswise." Thorne strode across the room, waving his arms. The kids followed behind him. "But now, look at this," Thorne said.
For months, we've been modifying his field vehicles, and finally, we're ready. He wants them light, I build them light. He wants them strong, I build them strong. Light and strong both, why not? It's just impossible what he's asking for. But with enough titanium and honey carbon composite, we're doing it anyway. He wants it off petroleum base and off the grid, and we do that too. So finally he's got what he wanted, an immensely strong portable laboratory to go where there's no gasoline and no electricity. And now that it's finished, I can't believe it. He really didn't show up for your class?
No, Kelly said.
So he's disappeared, Thorne said.
Wonderful.
Perfect. What about our field test? We were going to take these vehicles out for a week and put them through their paces.
I know, Kelly said. We got permission from our parents and everything, so we could go too.
And now, he's not here, Thorne fumed. I suppose I should have expected it. These rich kids, they do whatever they want. A guy like Levine gives Spoiled a bad name.
From the ceiling, a large metal cage came crashing down, landing next to them on the floor. Thorne jumped aside.
Eddie! Damn! Will you watch it?
Sorry, Doc, said Eddie Carr, high up in the rafters. But specs are it can't deform at 12,000 PSI. We had to test it.
That's fine, Eddie. But don't test it when we're under it!
Thorne bent to examine the cage, which was circular, constructed of inch-thick titanium alloy bars.
It had survived the fall without harm. And it was light. Thorne lifted it upright with one hand. It was about 6 feet high and 4 feet in diameter. It looked like an oversized birdcage. It had a swinging door fitted with a heavy lock.
What's that for? Arby asked.
Actually, Thorne said, it's part of that.
He pointed across the room where a workman was putting together a stack of telescoping aluminum struts.
High observation platform, made to be assembled in the field. Scaffolding sets up into a rigid structure, about 15 feet high. Fitted with a little shelter on top. Also collapsible.
A platform to observe what? Arby said.
Thorne said, he didn't tell you?
No,
Kelly said.
No,
Arby said.
Well, he didn't tell me either, Thorne said, shaking his head. All I know is he wants everything immensely strong. Light and strong. Light and strong. Impossible.
He sighed.
God save me from academics.
I thought you were an academic, Kelly said.
Former academic, Thorne said briskly. Now I actually make things. I don't just talk.
Colleagues who knew Jack Thorne agreed that retirement marked the happiest period in his life. As a professor of applied engineering and a specialist in exotic materials, he had always demonstrated a practical focus and a love of students. His most famous course at Stanford, Structural Engineering 101A, was known among the students as Thorny Problems, because Thorne continually provoked his class to solve applied engineering challenges he set for them. Some of these had long since entered into student folklore. There was, for example, the toilet paper disaster. Thorne asked the students to drop a carton of eggs from Hoover Tower without injury. As padding, they could only use the cardboard tubes at the center of toilet paper rolls. There were spattered eggs all over the plaza below. Then, another year, Thorne asked the students to build a chair to support a 200-pound man using only paper Q-tips and thread. And another time, he hung the answer sheet for the final exam from the classroom ceiling and invited his students to pull it down using whatever they could make with a cardboard shoebox containing a pound of licorice and some toothpicks. When he was not in class, Thorne often served as an expert witness in legal cases involving materials engineering. He specialized in explosions, crashed airplanes, collapsed buildings, and other disasters. These forays into the real world sharpened his view that scientists needed the widest possible education. He used to say, "How can you design for people if you don't know history and psychology?" You can't, because your mathematical formulas may be perfect, but the people will screw it up. And if that happens, it means you screwed it up. He peppered his lectures with quotations from Plato, Chaka Zulu, Emerson, and Shang Tzu. But as a professor who was popular with his students, and who advocated general education, Thorne found himself swimming against the tide. The academic world was marching toward ever more specialized knowledge, expressed in ever more dense jargon. In this climate, being liked by your students was a sign of shallowness, and interest in real-world problems was proof of intellectual poverty and a distressing indifference to theory. But in the end, it was his fondness for Shang Tzu that pushed him out the door. In a departmental meeting, one of his colleagues got up and announced that some mythical Chinese bullshitter means fuck all for engineering. Thorne took early retirement a month later, and soon after started his own company. He enjoyed his work thoroughly, but he missed contact with the students, which was why he liked Levine's two youthful assistants. These kids were smart, they were enthusiastic, and they were young enough so that the schools hadn't destroyed all their interest in learning. They could still actually use